Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you like myself on American soil, happy Memorial Day. We commemorate the memory of all the heroes, men and women throughout the ages who have helped fight to make the United States of America as wonderful and as great of a country as it is. So the Shiur is dedicated in all of their memory. We are up to Habakkuk, one of the least studied books in Tanakh, I'm sure. I've never done a survey of this, but I'm sure I'm right. The book of Habakkuk, we recite the third chapter of it on the second day of Shavuot as the Haftarah, which is how it made it into this series. And it's worthwhile because it's a very hard-hitting, short, punchy book that people don't study enough, and really they should. Let's get some setting here. In the late 7th century BCE, the Assyrians, who had been dominating the globe for quite a while, collapsed. The Babylonians were on the rise, and they were quickly destroying the formerly great and powerful Assyrian Empire, and the Babylonians were advancing all over the world. And the prophet Yirmiyahu, who was the main Navi of this time, the main prophet of this era, he had the prophetic foresight to understand that, okay, it's good that the Assyrians are going, but the Babylonians themselves pose an existential threat to the people of Israel and to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. And his party line through a 40-plus year career was that if we repent, God might help us against the Babylonians, but if we do not, we are vulnerable and could be destroyed. And the other one, which he picked up after the Babylonians formally took over the empire, was that we needed to surrender to them, pay taxes, be vassals, do not revolt, because if we revolt, that too will lead to a Babylonian counterattack that would be devastating. We failed in both of these in the end. We did not repent properly, nor did we remain faithful to the Babylonians. We ultimately revolted, and that cost us thousands of lives. Many other thousands were exiled, and the temple itself went up in flames in the year 586 BCE. If you read the book of Yirmiyahu, which is not today's Shiur, that's what you would get. Obviously, much more description than that, but all the same, that is the fundamental and primary point. Well, there was a different prophet who was active at that time, prior to the destruction, and he saw this from a different point of view. He agreed with Yirmiyahu's premises that the people of Israel were wicked. There was nothing to debate, but he had a different question. He decided, after getting a similar prophecy to that of Yirmiyahu, to throw it back at God, which is very brazen and very a lot of chutzpah, actually, to an extreme degree. He thought about it like this. Look, God, why are the Jews going to be devastated by the Babylonians? And God would respond, well, because the Jews are wicked. Well, so what should happen? Bad things should happen to bad people. Since the Jews are bad, bad things should happen to them. Okay. Divine Justice 101, that's a very basic point that we have. So Habakkuk is like, okay, that's true. The Jews are bad and therefore deserve to be punished. But look who's punishing them. The Babylonians. The Babylonians are A, not righteous, B, atrociously wicked, and C, most importantly, way more wicked than anything the Jews ever could come up with. So Habakkuk turns to God and says, look, God, if you're trying to teach us that bad things happen to bad people and that divine justice is served this way, this whole Babylonian invasion of Israel, which has not yet happened in the real time of the story, but it will, is a terrible failure educationally. And then Habakkuk, if that's not chutzpah enough, Habakkuk then demands a divine response. It's like, I'm sick and tired of complaining about this. I want to hear an answer. And so that's the fundamental gist of the setting of the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk protests God's seeming terrible injustice by bringing the Babylonians to attack Israel because the Babylonians are way more wicked. And then, of course, we'll have to spend some time today looking at, well, what is God's response? So without further ado, we open up with source number one. Again, I will read in the English, but you have the Hebrew right in front of you. The pronouncement made by the prophet Habakkuk. So that verse is an introductory verse, of course. How long, O Lord, shall I cry out and you not listen? Shall I shout to you violence and you not save? So Habakkuk is protesting injustice, and we see from the very opening verse of the book He obviously has been complaining about this for a long time before chapter 1. And he's sick and tired of no response from God. So the curtains open up on our biblical book, and we hear Habakkuk is very frustrated by now in the ongoing non-response of God. Go to verse 3. Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you look upon wrong? Raiding and violence are before me. Strife continues and contention goes on. Verse 4. That is why decision fails and justice never emerges. For the villain hedges the just man. Therefore, judgment emerges deformed. He's telling God, this is a terrible desecration of God's name. Justice is not being carried out, quite to the opposite. It's injustice that's happening now. Then he explains finally, after protesting, he lets us know the context of what he's talking about. Verse 5, look among the nations, observe well, and be utterly astounded. For work is being wrought in your days, which you would not believe if it were told. For lo, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that's another name for the Babylonians, that fierce, impetuous nation who cross the earth's wide spaces to seize homes not their own. So that's where he finally gives us the background of what he's talking about. The Babylonians are going to come. And Habakkuk says, well, that's just not fair. Why? Because the Babylonians are wicked. Habakkuk goes on for a while, and then he comes into verse 13. You, whose eyes are too pure to look upon evil, who cannot countenance wrongdoing. Why do you countenance treachery and stand by idle while the one in the wrong devours the one in the right? Respectfully to the Jewish Publication Society translation, which I've copied here, the Hebrew is Bivala Rasha Tzadik Mimenu. God is allowing the wicked one to devour the one who is more righteous than he. Habakkuk's Hebrew is much better, as usual, than the English. The English makes it sound like, oh no, the wicked are defeating the righteous. But that's wrong. That's not what Habakkuk is saying. Habakkuk admits in this sentence that the Israelites, the Jews, are wicked. He's just saying that the Babylonians are way more wicked. As many of our commentators point out, he's not saying, oh my goodness, how could bad things happen to good people? He's saying, granted that we are bad people and we deserve bad things, but the people doing those bad things are way worse. Even Ezra and Radak already point out what I am saying here. Okay. So I think Habakkuk makes his point clear, and then he takes a twisted page out of the prophetic playbook. The standard prophetic playbook would say, God, how could you allow the desecration of your name to happen? So Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, does this right after the golden calf. If you kill us, God, what will the Egyptians say? God is impotent. That's what they will say. So you don't want that to happen, and therefore you cannot destroy us. That is a common prophetic defense of the people of Israel. Habakkuk turns it around. He says in verse 16, that is why he, referring to the Babylonians, sacrifices to his trawl and makes offerings to his net. Look, if you let the Babylonians win, not only will that be a miscarriage of justice, but then they will bow down to their idols, basically. They'll sacrifice to their weapons. For through them his portion is rich and his nourishment fat. So he also calls that this will be a desecration of God's name, but in reverse. Not that, hey, people will say that God is weak, but to the contrary, they'll say that their gods and weapons are strong. Same idea, just different from the usual prophetic playbook. Okay, so you get Habakkuk's drift. To summarize chapter 1, Habakkuk is outraged as the curtains open up. I've been complaining about this God for a long time. It's simply unfair. You are creating a miscarriage of divine justice by allowing the Babylonians to come and defeat us. Yes, we're wicked, no complaints there, but they're way more wicked, and therefore they should not be successful. And if they are, it's a miscarriage of divine justice, and they will sacrifice to their gods, which will be a terrible desecration of God's name. Okay, very straightforward argument. Then we go to source number 2, which is just chapter 2. I will stand on my watch, take up my station at the post, and wait to see what he will say to me, what he will reply to my complaint. So the JPS translation has done a neat little move, which others have taken as well. Let's look at the Hebrew. I'm standing on my post to see what God will say to me. Uma ashiv al tochachti. If you know Hebrew, ma ashiv means what I will respond to my rebuke. Whereas the translation says what he will respond. that's a big change in the translation, just to make sure if you know the Hebrew, you could be like, whoa, how could they do that? The answer is that many of our commentators, they struggle with this expression. It should have said what he will say, because that's the whole point. Habakkuk, in the context of our book, is protesting against God, and now he wants to know, what will God respond? It should be, Uma yashiv al tochachti. It should be what he will say. The English reflects what should be here, but it's not there. So many of our mifarshim who take the ma'ashiv, what I will respond at its word, they take it like this. Habakkuk anticipates the obvious. If there's miscarriage of divine justice, people will come running to the prophet and say, hey, Habakkuk, what's going on here? This is terribly unfair. And Habakkuk has nothing to answer them because he doesn't know himself. So Rashi and many who follow suit understand the expression, Uma ashiv al tochachti, what I will respond to my rebuke. It's a way of saying, people rebuke me, says Habakkuk. Where is God? Where is the fairness here? And I need an answer for them. Whereas the JPS translation takes the view of Rav Menachem Bole in the Dat Mikra and others, modern scholars, who take for granted that really, 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 it should say what he will respond, because that's the contextually, that's correct. And this is what you and I would call in rabbinic parlance a tikkun sofrim. Let me just write that in the chat. A tikkun sofrim is when the prophet himself or the prophetic editors of a biblical book modify the Hebrew to be more respectful to God. In this context, it would be such chutzpah to say that Habakkuk is rebuking God, which is what's happening here, but you don't want to write that. So what you do is you change it to what I will respond to my rebuke. It's simply a matter of respect to God to not say bluntly in those words, I am rebuking God. And that's the logic of the Tikkun Sofrim situation. Okay, somebody stop.
Which is a common way to call the enemy, to use the term Oyve Yisrael to describe.
Correct. It's like a euphemism. Very good. Excellent. Okay, somebody has a hand up. Here we go. I don't know if the person who spoke says Zoom users. I can't say a name.
I also, it's Debbie
okay.
Santos.
Hi.
It also says right before that, Mayidaber bi.
Correct.
Mean, so it could also be a parallel phrase to that.
You're exactly right, which is why modern scholars typically understand that it's some kind of tikkun sofrim. It's a scribal emendation by the prophet himself or by the prophetic scribes who composed the final book, exactly like what you are saying. So yes, and it certainly meets the parallel much better if in fact it means what he will say. So I didn't feel bad including this translation, even though I know it's not a proper translation of the Hebrew, because it actually might be the intent of Habakkuk, exactly what you are saying. Either way, you understand the point. Habakkuk is demanding answers. He wants God to talk. So far, so good. Then God responds. So this clearly is the crux of the book. Whatever God says here must be very, very important, because after all these complaints for who knows how long by Habakkuk, all of a sudden things are now, God is going to respond. So here we are in verse 2. The Lord answered me and said, write the prophecy down, inscribe it clearly on tablets so that it can be read easily. This is like what you and I, in the age that we live in, we would say, God is telling Habakkuk, put this on a billboard so as people are whizzing by at 75 miles an hour, they'll get the answer to your question. Okay, so anything that you can pick up when you're driving at 75 miles an hour or even at the actual speed limit of 55, as you're whizzing by on the highway, it's got to be very short, sweet, and punchy, because the people making these billboards know that if they include a lot of text and any elaboration, you will not be able to see it. Okay. So God is essentially telling Habakkuk to make a billboard with the answer to the all-important problem of divine unfairness. So I don't know about the rest of you. Before we even get to what God says, I can't imagine that anybody is going to be able to give an answer to divine unfairness in an answer that would fit on a billboard. Because this is a very complicated question for us human beings. It's one that Tanakh constantly wrestles with, and one that Tanakh does not give a definitive answer to, because we simply do not know how God works or why there should be unfairness in the world. But whatever it is, God wants this to be on a billboard. So here goes. For there is yet a prophecy for a set term, a truthful witness for a time that will come. Even as it tarries, wait for it still, for it will surely come without delay. I'm not sure what that means, but okay. Lo, his spirit within him is puffed up, not upright, but the righteous man is rewarded with life for his fidelity. In Hebrew, it's v'tzadik emunato yichyeh. Okay, so I just blocked it off so you could just see the highlighted verses. So obviously the JPS translation is taking a side on how to translate it, because everybody needs to. Okay, so let's talk about divine unfairness for a minute. You know that sometimes, at least for us people, bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. What Habakkuk is raising here is not a new problem, nor is it unique to Habakkuk. It happens that this problem of divine unfairness is the problem that Tanakh created. Tanakh solves or at least addresses so many issues, but it created this one problem, which is, okay, God is all powerful. God is involved in our lives. God is fair. God even promises reward for righteous people and punishments for wicked people. Okay, as long as there is one exception to that, we have a problem, let alone if there are many exceptions in every generation. So that's the problem that Tanakh creates, and all people, including prophets, are aware of this problem. Now, there are different biblical books that come out on different paths in terms of how to approach this question. So, for example, the books of Tehillim, or Psalms, and the book of Mishlei, or Proverbs in English, they take a standard approach. That doesn't mean that all Psalms and all Proverbs have this one answer, but I am saying that this is a very commonplace response in these two biblical books. It goes something like this. If you see a righteous person suffering or a wicked person prospering, that could happen, but understand that this is very temporary. The wicked person will not die in his prosperity. Rather, he will lose all of his wealth or all of his good life, whatever the good life is. He will die and everything will be fair by the end. And similarly in reverse, if you see a wicked, righteous person suffering, okay, that could be, but just you wait and you will see his fortunes restored. You might find that answer satisfying or not, but that is a common approach that you will find throughout the book of Psalms, throughout the book of Proverbs. Yes, you could have temporary blips in the system, but these blips will always be erased before the relevant people die. Okay, so that's approach number one. Approach number two, such as in the book of Job or in the book of Kohelet/Ecclesiastes, there is no answer to human beings. The world is simply unfair through our human lens, and there's no way to solve this, and being patient does not always help solve things, as we all know. Sometimes wicked people will die when they're still doing very well, or righteous people will die when they still have not had their fortunes restored. We all know that those things are true. So the books of Job and the book of Kohelet reject the answer of, oh, be patient, things will even out before you die, because they know that that is not always true. And their response is a response. It's not an answer. They say, despite this palpable injustice in the world, our job is to be faithful to God and to be righteous. That is a righteous response to divine unfairness, but it is not an answer. The book of Psalms and the book of Proverbs give an answer. If you see injustice, don't worry, that will be fixed. That's an answer. Books of Job and Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, they take for granted that there is no answer available to people, and rather we must be righteous anyhow. Okay, so those are two fundamental approaches that you find in Tanakh, and funny enough, when it comes to these three words, v'tzadik be'emunato yichyeh, there is exactly that divide among our commentators. There's one camp of commentators that take this to be like the book of Psalms, and they read the verses like this. For there is yet a prophecy for a set term, a truthful witness for a time that will come. Even if it tarries, wait for it still, for it will surely come without delay. That refers to the fact that the Babylonians right now are indeed prospering, but the Babylonians will in fact fall, because any injustice is temporary. Lo, his spirit within him is puffed up. The Babylonians are arrogant, not upright. But the righteous man is rewarded with life for his fidelity. But anybody who is righteous, like the Jews, if we remain faithful, then we will survive and we will survive the Babylonians and we will live on. This view is adopted by, among others, Rashi and Radak. Let's get them in the chat just to give them some credit around here. They take this to mean that God is giving an answer to Habakkuk's question. Yes, you're right. When the Babylonians first win, that will be a temporary blip in fairness. You're right. But that will be overcome by the fact that if you're just patient, you will see the Babylonians will fall and the righteous Jews will prosper, even if they're not at this moment in time. So that is an answer to the problem of unfairness. So that's the approach of Rashi, Radak, and many others as well. And that view is simply the path of Psalms and Proverbs and books like that. Okay. Then there's a second approach. Let's give them some names too. Including Abarbanel and Malbim. Okay, we'll give them those two. That's enough. Abarbanel and Malbim say no. Habakkuk, or God here, is not giving an answer to the problem of unfairness. He's giving an approach. What is that approach? Let's read it again. Same verses, but a whole different reading. For there is yet a prophecy for a set term, a truthful witness for a time that will come. Even if it tarries, wait for it still, for it will surely come without delay. Right now the world is unfair. Lo, his spirit within him is puffed up. Wicked Jews are arrogant. It's not about the wicked Babylonians. Wicked Jews are arrogant, not upright, and therefore they lose faith when they see the Babylonians prospering. It's a response to a situation. But the righteous man will live in his faith, not is rewarded with life for his fidelity. V'tzadik b'emunato yechiyah means a righteous person sees that the world is unfair. He sees that the Babylonians are going to do great, and he sees that we're going to get crushed. And you know what? The righteous person remains righteous anyway. Not because there's an answer to this problem that Habakkuk has raised, but just because that's the proper righteous response. So from that perspective, this is not an answer to a problem of unfairness. This is simply how a righteous person should respond, and it is to be contrasted with what wicked people do when they respond. Okay, so this is a fundamental debate. Rashi and Radak and those who follow suit over there say, "Tzadik b'emunato yechiyah" means a righteous person actually will survive the Babylonian invasion. It's a physical prediction that they will live. It's an answer to the problem of unfairness. Whereas Abarbanel and Malbim and those who follow in that path say no. Habakkuk is saying, hey, it's unfair. And God is saying, okay, I'm not going to answer that one, but you should be righteous and cling to your faith despite this unfairness. But no answer forthcoming. Just to give you a sense of that second approach, we see it in Kohelet, source number 3. Here is a frustration that occurs in the world. Sometimes an upright man is requited according to the conduct of the scoundrel. Sometimes the scoundrel is requited according to the conduct of the upright. I say that all is frustration. He's very frustrated by this problem of unfairness. For I have set my mind to learn wisdom and to observe the business that goes on in the world, even to the extent of going without sleep day and night. Kohelet himself says, the wisest of all men, I have lost sleep over this problem of unfairness, and I have observed, verse 17, I have observed all that God brings to pass. Indeed, man cannot guess the events that occur under the sun, for man tries strenuously, but fails to guess them. And even if a sage should think to discover them, he would not be able to guess them. Kohelet formally says, there is no answer available to people for the problem of unfairness. He does not try to say, wait until later and everything will even out. He doesn't think there's any answer. God knows the answers. We don't. And it's beyond human wisdom. There is nothing we could do to change that status quo. And therefore, he says, our job is to live a righteous life. Okay, so that's Kohelet's approach, which follows, or, you know, predates, but it's the same approach as the second track that we saw with Tzadik b'emunato yechiyah. That even though the world is sometimes unfair, at least to human beings, our job is to live righteously anyway. Let's go to the book of Job, the other book that covers this whole issue. So the book of Job is a very interesting book. It's dedicated entirely to the problem of divine unfairness. Specifically when bad things happen to good people. It's the opposite of what Habakkuk is complaining about. But same general gist of things. So people don't give the Satan or Satan enough credit, but he deserves a lot of credit in the book of Job. In the book of Job, the book opens up with the heavenly host. God is up there talking to the Satan. In English, we say Satan. Satan is not a devil figure in Tanakh. Satan is simply the prosecuting angel in the heavenly court, but it's simply part of the angelic host. It's not an independent power. It's not evil. Satan is simply the prosecuting angel. So in the story, God is like, wow, that Job, he's so righteous and flawless and amazing. He does everything right. And the Satan says something back. He's very sarcastic and cynical about it. He says, Job is not righteous. Job is practical. After all, he serves you, God. That is true. But why does he serve you? He has 10 children. He's wealthy. He lives in peace. He has a wonderful, fabulous life. But if he suffered, he would never serve you, God. God is like, no, I'll bet you on that one. So Satan says, okay, you're on. And so they take a bet, and God allows the Satan to inflict terrible, terrible harm onto Eov. 10 sons die. He loses all of his wealth. He suffers physical afflictions. It's really very bad. Okay. So people don't give the Satan enough credit. What the Satan is doing right there in the introduction to the book of Job is actually giving the best possible approach to why the world needs to be unfair. If the world actually were fair all the time, well, the good news is then things would be fair and you and I would not have today's shiur. The bad news is nobody would actually ever be righteous. Because everybody would serve God only to get great rewards. If you knew that serving God really did produce great wealth, great family, great life in every way, and anytime we sinned, we would definitely, chas v'shalom, suffer all kinds of tragedies, sickness, poverty, etc., you know what? Nobody would ever be wicked, except for true psychopaths. Most people would understand it's just simply prudent to serve God, because then you get a nice reward. That's the Satan's argument. So the bottom line is that's not an answer to unfairness. It's simply a way of saying the world actually had to be unfair if God wanted to give us free will. There's no other way around it. Because if God is giving us choice, but always rewarded the righteous and punished the wicked, we actually would not really have a choice. So something has to give, and what gave was fairness. Okay. So that's a fabulous approach that people, again, don't credit the Satan enough for, but he deserves an awful lot of credit for just formulating it this way. But the bottom line is that means that the world is unfair. So what the book of Job never does, as the saga goes on, Job is now talking to his friends who are, well, they're not such good friends. They're trying to explain why God is obviously fair and why Job must have sinned. Job doesn't like that much. But the camera never shifts back to the heavenly host. We never see God and the Satan talking again. Which is too bad, because there actually is a moment in the book where God wins his $5 for this wager. But the book doesn't go back to that scene to let us know that. It's in source 4. After all of his suffering and complaining, tucked away in chapter 27, still the middle of the book, which goes 42 chapters, Job again took up his theme and said, by God who has deprived me of justice, by Shaddai who has embittered my life, as long as there is life in me and God's breath is in my nostrils, my lips will speak no wrong nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me to say you are right. Until I die, I will maintain my integrity. I persist in my righteousness and will not yield. I shall be free of reproach as long as I live. Here's exactly when God wins his bet against the Satan, because here the whole point is that despite the unfairness of it all, Job chooses to remain faithful to God. And that's all part of the second track of what Tzadik Be'emunato Yechye means. That even though we see unfairness and we don't know why that should be, our job as righteous people is to remain righteous. That's exactly what Job is doing here. Okay. The Talmud says this in even more dramatic form, and that's in source number 5. This is the passage that comes up with the traditional number that God gave 613 commandments in the Torah. Nowhere in the Torah is it clear how many commandments there are. There are many, but there's no good way to count. The Talmud comes along with this number 613, which becomes the traditional number for how many mitzvot there are, for how many commandments there are. Second. The Talmud then goes on, going through the Psalms and various prophetic passages, showing how different psalmists and prophets boiled down what is the essence of Judaism. What is the essence of the Torah? So we have here, David came and reduced them to 11 principles. And they quote some psalm. Isaiah came and reduced them to 6 principles. Micha came and reduced them to 3 principles. Again came Yeshayahu and reduced them to 2 principles. But it is Habakkuk who came and based them all on 1 principle. As it is said, but the righteous shall live by his faith. So this Talmudic passage seems to favor the second view of Habakkuk also, the idea that God never answers the prophet and tells him why it is okay for wicked Babylonia to be successful. All he's saying is, Habakkuk, wicked Babylonia is going to be successful because that is my plan. And your job and all righteous people's job is to remain righteous. That is the essence of the Torah, according to this passage. It's really remarkable. Okay, this is a good place to pause. I see something's in the chat. Please enlarge the screen. I don't even know how to do that. I think it, for me, at least, it's as large as it can be. I don't see if I can.
What about Olam Haba?
What about Olam Haba? Let me just see if I can do Zoom. 1 second. Video. Whoa. Too many. Oh, I see.
You're kidding.
Each person should be able to enlarge the screen themselves by pinching it out.
I would think so too, but hold on. How's that? I hope that's better.
It is.
That's nicely bigger for me.
Okay, good. All right, so getting back to the main issue at hand. So to summarize what we have so far, there's a huge debate among our commentators over whether Habakkuk receives an answer from God that if you're just patient, you will see the Babylonians will fall and the Jews will again rise, in which case everything will be fair in the end. And the second approach is, I'm not telling you why the Babylonians should succeed. That's my business, says God, without saying that. But rather, your job is to be righteous, even though, yes, things seem very unfair to you. And that second approach seems to be espoused by Kohelet, the Book of Job, and even in Masechet Makot, over here that we saw in source number 5. Somebody asked, what about Olam Haba, the world to come? That's its own shiur. It's an excellent shiur. It's just not today's shiur. I can only give a 1 sentence. I mean, I'm not standing right now. I'm sitting. But were I standing, I would do this while standing on 1 foot, just because it's a very weighty question and a very important one. Olam Haba, afterlife, is simply never used in Tanakh as an answer to the problem of unfairness until the last biblical books, Daniel and Malachi. Until then, everybody understands that when God promises good things happening to good people and bad things happening to bad people, that refers to life in this world. Just read the whole Torah. You will see that that is correct. Job's friends never say, in all of their attempts to justify God, they never say, well, Job, maybe you're right. Maybe you're suffering even though you're righteous. But oh boy, you're going to get a great share in heaven. That is not an available answer during the overwhelming majority of the biblical period. And so afterlife is simply not part of that. We believed in afterlife. We've had a belief in afterlife is very, very ancient. It simply was never used to solve this problem of unfairness until the very end of the biblical period. And then the rabbis accepted this as the way to deal with it. So we rabbinic Jews understand that's now part of the discussion. But in Habakkuk's world, that was not an available option. So it's just important to understand the timeline of this idea. Again, that's a whole different shiur and a really good one, I would add, but simply not today's shiur. But so thank you for raising it. But that's the al regel achat, while standing on 1 foot, at least metaphorically, response. Okay, let me just make sure that I'm covered on the chat. Okay, good. I think we're fine with the chat. Excellent. Because I think we're now good and happy. Now we get to chapter 3. After chapters 1 and 2, which do what we just discussed, chapter 3 is actually the Haftarah for the second day of Shavuot. And the reason why it's there is really a midrashic. The reason why we read it on Shavuot is because our ancient sages already made various midrashic links to God's awesomeness, which is what the psalm is about, and they tie that to the revelation at Sinai. So once that you're tying it to Sinai, then it is an obvious choice for a Haftarah on Shavuot, and indeed it's been for a very, very, very long time. But in the Pshat, simply looking at what the text is talking about, there's another dimension that helps us with today's Shiur. Habakkuk describes all kinds of terrible things that will happen to Israel, and there's a debate over what specific terrible things, but it will end up being the same for us. Source number 6. I heard and my bowels quaked. My lips quivered at the sound. Rot entered into my bone. I trembled where I stood. Yet I wait calmly for the day of distress, for a people has come to attack us. Though the fig tree does not bud and no yield is on the vine, though the olive crop has failed and the trees fields produce no grain, though sheep have vanished from the fold and no cattle are in the pen, yet will I rejoice in the Lord. Let's pause for a second. So there's a debate among our classical commentators about what specific disaster Habakkuk is thinking about. In the context of the book that we are in, it sounds like the answer should be the Babylonian invasion, because that's what everything has been about up until now. And since verse 16 talks about a people come to attack us, well, that's the people it would be. So that's one angle, and that makes a lot of sense to me. Others focus on the fact that verse 17 sounds like it's about some kind of famine. So you could just say that the famine comes because of the Babylonian invasion. They're killing a lot of people and burning the place to the ground. Famine might very well come as a result of that. But you could say that it's referring to some independent famine, like a drought or a locust plague or something like that. Could be. Others take this to be some messianic age thing, and we refer to this as the War of Gog and Magog. At the end of times, there's going to be some great coalition against Israel, and this prophecy refers to that. Whichever one makes you happy, it's fine with me. What I care about for today is, regardless, Habakkuk is doing something very important, which is, despite the fact that some great catastrophe is incoming, verse 18, yet will I rejoice in the Lord, exult in the God who delivers me. Not because of any salvation, but rather, v'tzadik be'munato yichyeh. Habakkuk chooses to live a righteous life, even though something very bad is going to happen. Sounds like he himself has progressed from his protest days in chapters 1 and 2, and he realizes, look, I don't have any answers or solutions to the problem of unfairness, but I love God, I cling to God no matter what, and I rejoice in God even though I can't understand why we have an invasion or a famine or any of those things. Verse 19, my Lord God is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's and lets me stride upon the heights for the leader with instrumental music. So he turns it into a moment for religious growth rather than a moment of total despair because the world is unfair. Okay, we've taken 38 minutes to deal with the pshat in the book of Habakkuk, the plain sense of the text as it emanates from the text itself. We talked about the debate over chapter 2, verse 4, the key expression of v'tzadik be'munato yichyeh, the righteous shall live by his faith, which could either mean righteous people will actually live because they are righteous, they will physically survive the destruction, or it just means that when there is unfairness in the world, wicked people will despair and give up on God, and righteous people will stand by God anyway and keep their faith, even though we cannot know. That, to me, is the basic pshat axis of the book of Habakkuk. But there's one more leg of this journey for today, and that is the rabbis have an interesting quandary with Habakkuk. They know what we all know. The prophets are the supreme men and women of God. These are people who achieved the pinnacle of religious experience. Not only are they greatly righteous themselves, but God communicates with them in some form or another. And that's amazing. Okay, so that makes them our ultimate religious role model. And so if we have a biblical passage of Habakkuk screaming at God for being a terrible educator, that should be a role model moment for us. The only thing is, the rabbis didn't really want us to talk to God that way. The rabbis of the Talmud have an interesting quandary because you're dealing with a prophet of God, kicking and screaming and saying that God is failing as an educator. So the question is, how do we apply or not apply Habakkuk to our own lives? And that's a really interesting and powerful question. So here the sages of the Midrash and later commentaries struggle with that precise issue. We start with source number 7 over here, Midrash Psalms. Oh, hold on 1 second. Before we get there, let's check out the chat. How does Avram arguing with God over destroying Sodom if there are righteous people fit in with this? Avram seems to be displaying chutzpah. You are most certainly correct, Shelley Shapiro. Avraham, in fact, is the very first person in this great prophetic tradition. And so I agree with you. And in fact, to me, it's very clear that Habakkuk simply fits into this long-standing prophetic tradition, starting exactly with Avraham. That's the right place to start in this saga. That all being said, whatever Avraham said, God forbid, how could you possibly create an injustice, is less chutzpah than this, where Habakkuk is kicking and screaming and saying that God is desecrating his own name. Habakkuk is definitely a greater, it's a matter of degree though, but fundamentally you're completely correct. It's certainly in the same spectrum of prophetic protest. But some of the rabbis thought that Habakkuk went over too many lines here. So there are different approaches to how to deal with that and how to apply it. The most extreme is what we have here in source number 7. I find it remarkable still. I know that the source exists because, hey, it's in my source sheets. But all the same, I cannot believe that it's really here. But yet it is. Hold on 1 second. So there's a verse in Kohelet or Ecclesiastes, keep your mouth from being rash. When Habakkuk said, I will stand up on my watch, take up my station at the post, we saw that verse inside. This teaches that he drew a form, Tsar Tzura, and stood in its midst. So he drew like a circle on the ground and said, I'm not moving from here. Right? He said, I will not move from here until you answer me. Hey, God, I'm sick and tired of complaining about this. I've been demanding answers long enough. I'm not going to move until you answer me. So in the Midrash, in the text, we saw what God actually gives a response. And you could debate what that response means, but God does respond to him. But in the Midrash, God replied, you are not an ignoramus, but rather a Torah scholar. You understand that this is the Midrash projecting onto God, but what the Midrash is saying is, Habakkuk is speaking like an unlearned fool. He is not speaking like a prophet of God. That is tremendous chutzpah of this sage who's writing this Midrash. To call a prophet an ignoramus is remarkable, meaning that he's acting as one. But what the Midrash is trying to say here is, it's a remarkable thing. They're saying, Habakkuk sinned. Now, by saying that, they're obviously telling us, never, ever, ever do this at home. Right? Do not apply Habakkuk's teaching to your own religious life. Never pray like this. It's not okay. It's not even okay for Habakkuk. So in this Midrash, when Habakkuk heard this, he fell on his face and supplicated. You understand, none of this is in the text of Habakkuk. He said, Master of the universe, do not judge me as a willful transgressor, but rather as an inadvertent sinner. In Hebrew, that's shogeg. This is what is written, a prayer of the prophet Habakkuk in the mode of shigyonot. In the pshat, as many of our commentators point out, in the mode of shigyonot refers to either a musical instrument or a rhythm. It's a musical term, an ancient musical term. I don't know what, because I don't sing in the temple choir from 2,000 years ago. But they knew exactly what this meant. The conductor would have known what to do. The band would have known what to do. The choir would have known what to do. I don't know what to do. I'm not from tribe of Levi, so what can I do? But the Midrash is making a drasha that shigyonot sounds like the word shigaga, which means error. So in the pshat, in the plain sense of what Habakkuk is talking about, he's not repenting for anything. He's simply singing a psalm of praise to God, chapter 3. But in this Midrash, the psalm is coming to atone for the terrible sin of having so much chutzpah against God's judgment. That's how this Midrash is reading it. So this is not what the text of Habakkuk is saying, but I care very much about what the sages are saying here, which is Habakkuk sinned by speaking this way, and therefore had to repent for his terrible transgression of speaking so brazenly against God. According to the author of this Midrash, the point is, never, ever, 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 ever pray this way. Not even a prophet is allowed to pray that way. Okay, so that's approach number one. Approach number two, which you'll find in many more parallel sources in different contexts, is the story of Choni. As usual, we Jews today very often learn the whole thing backwards because very few Jews ever learn Habakkuk. I'm glad we're learning it today. It's a good occasion to do that. But the story of Choni is actually in children's books. I've known the story of Choni since I was a little kid. So the story of Choni is from a much later period. It's from the time of the rabbis already. Shimon ben Shetach was the main rabbi of that time. They didn't even use the term rabbi yet, but he was the leading sage. And there was some drought in the rabbinic period. And so the rabbis did what you're supposed to do. They prayed, they had public fasts, they did everything they're supposed to do. And you know what? There still was no rain. So the people were getting desperate. The rabbinic, respectful way of fasting and praying and repenting, none of this was working. We had no rain. Okay. So people, out of sheer desperation, said, let's try the holy man. Maybe he can get God to give rain. So they sent a message to Choni. Pray that rain may fall. He prayed and no rain fell. First he tried good old regular praying, God, please send rain, and God did nothing. He thereupon drew a circle and stood within it in the same way that as the prophet Habakkuk had done. As it is said, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower. Obviously, in the children's book, they don't mention Habakkuk because they know quite well. Nobody has heard of Habakkuk. But all the same, when you're in the shiur, you realize, oh, the whole Choni story is modeled after what we've been learning together. The holy man draws a circle in the ground and demands rain. And so he demands rain, and if you know the rest of the story, it rained. So poor Shimon ben Shetach, he's in a tough bind here. He's trying to teach Jews how to pray. We pray respectfully, we fast, we repent. And then here you have the holy man saying, okay, God, I'm not moving from here until there is rain. So Shimon ben Shetach wants to handle it the way that he does. So the story continues. Thereupon, Shimon ben Shetach sent this message to him. If you were not Choni, I would have excommunicated you. But what can I do to you who act petulantly before the omnipresent, before God, and he grants your desire, as a son who acts petulantly before his father and grants his desire? What's this Talmudic passage saying? If you are as righteous as Habakkuk and Choni, if you pray this way, we can't say no because you're so righteous and so close to God. Speak your mind. But dear anybody reading this story, never, ever, ever pray this way or I'm going to excommunicate you. So this passage differs from this previous source, source number 7. Source number 7 said Habakkuk sinned. Source number 8 is saying, okay, we're not allowed to say that Habakkuk sinned because he's a prophet for crying out loud. Let's leave him alone and let's leave Choni alone. And we can't help but notice that God responded to Habakkuk and God responded to Choni. So if God approves, we can't say boo. But what we can say is only this righteous 0.00001% ever can talk to God this way. When you're this close to God, go ahead. Until then, you better never pray this way. And that's a way of restricting us regular folk from ever, ever, ever speaking to God this way. So that's a second approach that you find in classical sources. We'll do one other one, and that is Ibn Ezra. Poor Rav Avraham Ibn Ezra, one of the great Pashtanim of all time. Okay, so he can't do those two moves. He's not going to criticize the prophet. He's not even going to say, oh, only the most righteous. He's bothered by the fact that Habakkuk spoke this way. And he shouldn't have. He thinks that it's wrong. He basically agrees with source number 7. So he comes up with a trick which he uses throughout Tanakh when he's bothered by biblical verses. And that's what he does here is in source number 9. This prophet, referring to Habakkuk, began to quote the righteous of Israel who were shouting to God on account of Nebuchadnezzar's atrocities. According to Ibn Ezra, we have to assume Habakkuk never actually said this. Because a prophet would never talk to God this way. So he's quoting other people who were saying this at this time. And Habakkuk is simply coming to God and saying, God, what am I going to do? So look what these people are saying. How should I answer them? Ibn Ezra finds a way by creating an implied speaker. So that way the prophet never really said this on his own. That's Ibn Ezra's trick that he uses throughout all of Tanakh. The reality is, though, it sounds like Habakkuk really did say this, and it sounds like God did not rebuke him, and it sounds like what he did was fine. The reality is that in our prayer book, we never pray to God this way. In our public prayers that the sages compiled, they never, ever include a prayer this blunt. But simultaneously, Tanakh does keep this prayer, or protest, whatever you want to call it, because obviously there is a place for this kind of protest. As somebody said earlier, Avraham Avinu is the one who started this track. I totally agree with that approach. And once you have Avraham actually doing this, later prophets follow suit precisely because they have such an honest relationship with God. okay, if the divine was upset, wouldn't the divine take care of the problem? So I agree with that. So I don't think that God is criticizing Habakkuk at all. If the rabbis are saying that Habakkuk as a Navi has no right to address God the way he did, how do they explain Jonah's refusal to prophesy to Nineveh? That's also another shiur, another excellent shiur, by the way, but oh my goodness, I can't go into Yonah right now because that requires a full-blown shiur to go through various approaches to Yonah's reluctance, which is a really interesting question, but I can't deal with him today just because that's its own shiur. So to summarize, we've seen three different ways of trying to deflect Habakkuk's level of protest. Approach number one is Habakkuk's sin. Approach number two is Habakkuk did not sin because he's a prophet, but nobody else can pray like that. If you and I pray like that, we are sinning. And then there's the third approach, that of Ibn Ezra, which is Habakkuk actually never said this at all. Habakkuk simply is quoting other people and now is pleading with God, please help me come up with a response to these people. But the fourth approach, which I think is the most straightforward approach to the book, is that, of course, Habakkuk said it. He's not quoting anybody else here. Habakkuk is simply in the spirit of Avraham Avinu, exactly what somebody said in the chat earlier. I couldn't agree more. And his closeness to God demands that he simply speaks his entire heart and soul to God. In this case, he sees a problem, which is, from my limited human perspective, prophet or not, I'm still a human being. I don't understand how the Babylonians can succeed. They're terrible. And within the second track that we saw, what God is responding is, our job is to be righteous even though we cannot understand the unfairness in this world. And that's V'tzadik be'emunato yichyeh. So when you think about the two haftarot of, just to tie this all together, last week and this week, two haftarot of Shavuot. Here we are taking two prophetic passages that pertain to the revelation at Sinai and our acceptance of the Torah. Day number one talks about how, wow, God reveals himself. How overwhelmingly awesome. That's the Maaseh HaMerkava that we talked about last week. This week is about how God reveals himself, but you and I as mortals can't fully fathom God. And that's simply rigged into our religious system. There is no way. Even Moshe Rabbeinu cannot fully understand God, let alone us regular folk. So us regular folk have Habakkuk, who's kicking and screaming for us, saying there's some unfairness in this world. How do we deal with that? And God's response in the second day is, I'm not going to tell you, but our job is to be faithful even when we don't understand everything about the world we live in or everything about God. I think that's a very profound pair of messages that we get for the holiday of Shavuot. Okay, so that concludes my piece in the Shiur, and so we'll take the remaining couple of minutes. If anybody else have further comments or reflections, what I am going to do is stop this screen share so I can actually see more of your faces, which I was unable to do this entire time. Okay. Ben Melech, take it away.
All right. One of your responses earlier reminds me of the politician's response, where they don't have an answer and they kick the problem down the road. It will be solved down the road, which is really not an answer. It's just saying, you don't know enough today, or you don't patient enough today, you know, or, you know, the deficit will solve itself 20 years from now. In the meantime, vote for me and we'll spend your tax money. So I don't view it as a real answer when you're kicking something down the road. People need answers, concrete answers today and, you know, within a reasonable period of time. It's also, contextualizes for me a little bit more of how the early Jewish Christians got away with stuff. Well, the J guy didn't solve the problem now, but wait a few years, he'll come back to life and it'll solve the problem. That's not really an answer we like or is acceptable.
Okay, fair enough. So I will tell you like this. That's why there are two tracks in Tanakh. One track is, here's an answer. If you just wait till the end of somebody's life, it will always get evened out. But the reality is, that's not true. That's what Kohelet and the book of Job address. That's simply not true sometimes, right? Granting that it is untrue to all human experience, any human being would agree with what I just said. It's not just my personal opinion here. It's just the reality. Kohelet is the one who enshrines it in his book, but all the same, it is just simply the reality. So what do you do? God is not giving an answer, nor is he kicking the can down the road. He's saying, I'm not going to answer you at all, and you're going to remain frustrated by this. And now, but the right righteous response is to serve God because that is our obligation. Right? So I consider that a mature level of faith. It's not the same thing as, oh, my policies may be terrible, but in 20 years, you'll see why my policies are good, so pay a lot of taxes. I would rather pay fewer taxes or at least have an explanation of why those taxes actually are beneficial to our society. Right? So on the human plane, people should be able to explain themselves and their policies. It's not the same as politicians at all. God is not kicking a can down the road. He's not kicking any can. He's saying, I'm not going to tell you. Divine unfairness is simply rigged into the system in the second approach. And somebody who wants to despair will despair of faith. But the faithful response, obviously, is to have a more sophisticated faith, which is we don't have answers to all of the questions.
Would you say that?
Ben, let's just give other people a chance now. So, Debbie, you had your hand up?
Never mind. I took it down. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else?
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Of course. Please do. Susan.
Sorry. Going back to the Ma'ashiv and the weather, who is saying those things? Is Hashem saying that you have to, even if you don't understand me, you have to live by your faith, or is Habakkuk saying that? Who's giving which answer? Is Hashem giving both? Is Habakkuk giving both? I've got confused.
Sorry. So when the expression "Bitzadik be'emunato yichyeh," which this entire shiur is turning on, that's God's voice in chapter 2, verse 4.
Right.
God is the one who is saying that. And then there's a debate whether that reflects an answer, that if you're just patient, you'll see the Babylonians will fall and the Jews will survive if they are righteous. Right? That's an answer to the problem. The second approach is, no, God is saying, I'm not going to answer this at all, but rather wicked people will take this unfairness as means to walk away from God, whereas righteous people will live in their faith even though they don't understand why this is happening.
Either way we look at it, but that's Hashem's answer to Habakkuk. It's not
that
like,
is correct.
He is getting an answer.
He's getting a response.
Response. Okay, response. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, yes. Anybody else?
Can you address the question about the Dead Sea Scroll, the Habakkuk Pesher, in the chat?
Oh, now I see it. The rabbis are saying, I don't see a Habakkuk Pesher in the chat. Hold on, I'm scrolling around. Oh, it's all the way back here. I'm sorry. Oh, so that's a separate type of, that's not even a shiur. That's a lecture. The gist of it is, I mean, the Pesher people, the Dead Sea sect, they're not reading Pshat in Habakkuk. They saw that Habakkuk was talking about them. So you should read, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to read about. There's all kinds of literature on Pesher Habakkuk. I remember writing a term paper for it on that in graduate school. It was really interesting. And I just learned so much about how the Pesher people, how the Dead Sea sect read the book of Habakkuk as though it was written for them. Not that they can learn from it. We learned Habakkuk as, okay, Habakkuk was written for all Jews of all time. But they didn't see it that way. They saw it as it was written specifically for their group, and that they were the righteous ones, of course, and that we rabbinic Jews and the other groups that were out there are the wicked ones. But that's a whole separate, that's a separate thing. Okay, somebody named Nazar has a hand up.
Yeah, how's the response of Habakkuk, or God's response in the book of Habakkuk, correlates with the response of God to Job when he asks for an answer, in the sense that Job was told that where you were when I created the world, and so on?
Great question. So in my view, since I like the second opinion of Habakkuk's approach, which is that he's not getting an answer, but rather a response, then God's response to Job or Eov is exactly the same thing, which is, you don't understand the world because you are human. I created the world, so I understand how it works, says God. But God never answers Eov as to why is he suffering. So it's exactly the same point, which is, I salute your righteousness. But simultaneously, there is no, you know, it's a response. You are being righteous despite not understanding, but people cannot understand. Okay, one more question, Shelley. Shelley Shapiro?
Yeah, I'm wondering, If we're not supposed to ask questions, it says Noach ish tzaddik bedorotam. Even Midrash, Noach never asked God, what I should be doing. You know, why doesn't pray for the people of the time to God have mercy on them? He just goes and builds the ark over this long period of years to, you know, if people ask him, fine. If they don't, fine. So God could have picked another person in Abraham's generation like that. He didn't. We don't know why he picked Abraham, but Abraham asked questions and God doesn't seem to get upset about it. So why later on are we not allowed to ask God why stuff happens?
I agree with you. Our tradition very much, not only are we allowed to and encouraged to ask questions, but the whole point of this shiur is that we are forced to live with questions. The book of
Habakkuk. You don't get answers.
The book of Habakkuk tells us that not only do we ask questions, we should ask questions. But not only that, but it demands that good faith requires that we live with questions that we simply cannot solve. On that incredibly happy note, I see that we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for your ongoing participation and thank you for your wonderful questions at the end and comments throughout. And I look forward to our final 2 weeks, which will be on the book of Ruth. So I look forward to seeing you next Monday. And again, happy Memorial Day to all U.S. citizens out there, myself included. Take care.